dig it.
Stop. Right on.
From the campus of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to WSSU Future Focus. Everything Winston-Salem State University. And now your host, WSSU Chancellor Elwood Robinson.
We welcome a very special guest to Future Focus Now. At the intersection of social justice, political empowerment, human development, and cultural arts, one will find Latasha Brown. As a catalyst for change, thought leader, and social strategist, her national and global efforts have been known to organize, inspire, and catapult people into action, enabling them to build power and wealth for themselves and their community. Honored to receive the 2010 White House Champion of Change Award, the 2006 Spirit of Democracy Award, and the Lewis Burnham Award for Human Rights, it is more than evident that she is passionate about social change for the purpose of advancing humanity, creating a more equitable redistribution of wealth and power around the world. Latasha is the co-founder of the Black Voters Matter Fund and the BVM Capacity Building Institute. She's adamant about ensuring that all human beings have access to quality education, safety, security, peace, love, and happiness, striving daily to hear the voices of women in leadership amplified and supported. She's working to eliminate human suffering through her vision of the Southern Black Girls and Women's Consortium, recognizing that her work is not rooted in strengthening political systems, government, or institutes, but in the advancement of people. Latasha serves as the authoritative figure in the lives of thousands, if not millions. More than ever, she's crystallized clear that she is called to remind people of the power they hold within, pushing them through the birthing process of vision to manifestation. Transforming culture through her singing and songwriting, this innovative storyteller is shifting the narrative of African Americans through media, campaigns, and nonprofit projects featured on CNN, HBO, MSNBC, and Fox, just to name a few. Latasha also proudly serves as the founding of Saving Ourselves Coalition, a community-led disaster relief organization that helped hundreds of families in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Currently, she serves on the board of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation, the Southern Documentary Fund, and the U.S. Human Rights Network, and the Congressional Progressive Caucus Center. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to my guest tonight, Ms. Latasha Brown.
Greetings. How are you?
Greetings. No, how are you? The busiest woman in the world, or certainly the America. We thank you for taking a few minutes to sit with us on Future Focus Now at Winston-Salem State University. The Winston-Salem State University community is on fire because you are here with us tonight. Latasha, how are you?
You know what? I am well. I am. It's been interesting. It's been a hard, you know, this has been a hard year, right?
Yeah.
A hard year with COVID-19. With the most intense campaign I've ever been involved in, and I've worked in over 48 campaigns. You know, then we had the Senate race. It was like the never ending, and now we're in this fight around voting rights, to protect voting rights. And so, you know, it's interesting. I was lamenting the other day, or I was like, I was just, it never stops. You know, and just really what came to my spirit is, you know, we're looking at one thing, right? But the truth of the matter is human beings are creative and we're resilient and our people are resilient. And so it is also an opportunity for us to reassert ourselves, exactly. Right? Not necessarily just about kind of the right to vote, but really around as a community, thinking about power and thinking about how we're going to use power and how we're going to create systems that will protect our power. And so that instead of us being in this constant hamster wheel, right. You know, that of trying to get some folk to act right, that ultimately what we need to do, and I think what we're being called for at this moment, is to actually use our talents, our creativity. That we're also, we got to stop some things, but we got to radically reimagine some other things. And so, So in that space, you know, sometimes until the, like my grandfather used to say, until the comfort of staying the same, the discomfort of staying the same becomes greater than the discomfort to change, you won't ever change. And so right now we're in this moment of discomfort, but it's actually providing an opportunity for us to be different. It's providing an opportunity for us to look at ourselves different, to look at our power differently.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I did an interview, last year, and someone asked me as chancellor of a university, you know, what is like, you know, during the pandemic and, you know, all the things that are happening. And I told them, you know, it really is, it wasn't as bad as people realize because we went to work. I mean, we thought about what was next. I mean, because, you know, for me, I've been on the planet for a long time. This wasn't anything new to me. And I know that we had to regroup and readjust to that. I'm wondering for you in terms of the amazing work that you have been a part of, certainly what happened in Georgia and all eyes on Georgia. I can't remember a time when there were so many eyes on one state that people were looking at. But when you pull back and you look at the work of last year during the election, when you get a chance to self-reflect, what do you look at and what are you most proudest of? And do you say to yourself, like, we did this? And can you believe that we did this?
Well, the first thing I did right was the day I started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. Chancellor, you and I are from a people that we have always risen above the odds. Like if it was up to some element and some energy in this country, we wouldn't even be alive. Right. You would certainly not be leading institutions like education institutions, a college. What are you saying? We would not be on television. We would not. We have always been literally, we are the descendants, you know, of people who knew that their humanity is actually what would open up the opportunity, that their work, that their talents, that their gifts would make room for them. And so I say that while what happened in Georgia, you know, while on the surface it looks like it was about a campaign and putting a president in office and a black woman as vice president and all those things happen, right? But the thing that I'm most proud of is black people. That black folks, in spite of the voter suppression, right, in spite of having COVID, and COVID was devastating in our community. At one point in April, 80%, and Georgia is a state that is 30% African American. In April of last year, at the height of COVID, 80% of all hospitalizations related to COVID were black people.
Wow.
In a state that were only 30% of the population, right? It was devastating for us. In spite of that, in spite of the hot mess of a primary that we saw in June of last year, if you remember in the spring, early spring or summer of last year, if you recall, there were people that stood in line 11 hours.
Right.
Matter of fact, my co-workers and I, my partner and workers and I were out at a polling site in Union City, Georgia, and stayed with a woman who cast her vote till 12:37 a.m.
Wow.
We did not leave, which means it took her she did not vote until Wednesday of the next day. Right. So it wasn't that I'm raising that because I'm super, super proud of the work that we did.
Yeah.
What I am so proud of is that our people, not just that they voted. To me, the voted was an outgrowth of something greater. What I'm proud of is that our people believed in themselves, that they actually believed that they had agency, and that in spite of, well, nobody gonna turn, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. It was in that same spirit that that was was like kind of the foundation of movement. We would see that when we would go to communities, people come out their door. It's like, baby, I already got my absentee ballot. We couldn't even tell them. It's like, I got it. You know, the brothers on the street put their fists up. There was something, there was an energy that we had of really recognizing our collective power. You know, there were some things that we did that were super, super fun. Mm-hmm. One of the events that we had, which is for Christmas, we had Soul Santa. And Soul Santa went around, we were going around Georgia and we gave out toys and we had the Christmas playlist with Donny Hathaway and the Temptations. And, you know, what was beautiful about the process is that we were creating community. Sure. So that it wasn't about this extractive process that you go into communities and you just ask because you want something from them. We just want you to vote. But we were actually going, it was a very generative process that we were going into communities. We were actually educating and giving people the opportunity to engage in this election, let them know how important it was. But more important than anything, we were actually reminding them of who we are as a people, reminding them of our power and literally creating community. Having block parties, having toy giveaways, right, having food giveaways, things that affirm that we see you, that we care about you beyond your vote, that we know that people were struggling in rural Georgia. And so as a result, between November and December, we provided food for over 20,000 families.
Wow.
Because we knew that COVID-19 had a particular kind of impact on our community. We knew that in order to get this work done, it wasn't about one organization stockpiling resources, that we literally had to create a vehicle to be able to share resources. And so last year, we actually supported over 600 organizations. We directly invested, we wrote checks.
Wow.
Over $2 million that we actually gave to Black-led organizations, grassroots groups, community organizations, the Divine Nine, you name it. Like what we wanted to do is it's almost kind of, we saw ourselves as a vessel. We didn't see ourselves as a source, right? That we would be a vessel to be able to distribute resources to our people to let us do what we do, because we know what to do, our people do what they do.
Absolutely. Before we get too far into the discussion, tell us about you, co-founder of Black Voters Matter and Southern Black Girls Consortium. Tell us about those two organizations and those two groups.
I sure will. So Black Voters Matter Fund and Black Voters Matter Capacity Builder Institute was conceptualized and founded by myself and my amazing brother leader, Cliff Albright, who's a brilliant strategist and long-term activist and writer and scholar himself. And so over the years, for the last 25 years, we've been working in some form or fashion to really help build power for Black folks, particularly in the Black Belt. In the region where our people were formerly enslaved. And so we had this vision that what we wanted to do was that we wanted to build power for our people, and that it wouldn't be contingent upon a political candidate or political party, but in fact, it would be based on how those communities define whatever that power that was that they desired. Whether it's for some communities, they wanted to do a referendum so they could actually have a oversight for the police. You know, there are some communities that want to take over the school board. There are some communities that want to have Black representation, whatever that is. That we would actually show up in that space with those communities as partners and bring resources and our talents and our skills and a platform to help them really be able to build that power. And so over a number of years, we started in 2016, but to be honest, it was probably, you know, we created maybe 20 years ago when it didn't have a name. We were just starting to do the work. So we took it to the lab. We were in the lab for about 25 years. So once we rolled it out, what we knew is we wanted an organization that did a couple of things. One, that we created Black Voters Matter Fund because we were very intentional about, we wanted to fund the work that's happening on the ground. That part of what we felt was the missing link is that it wasn't that the South was red. It wasn't that our people didn't want power, that we were grossly underinvested. And our belief, our theory of change was that if we could get resources to the ground, you know, to people in their communities, that they care and they're embedded in their communities, they're the best people to lead this work. that could make a difference in the process. And so we created an organization that, one, would provide those resources. Two, we understood that many of the groups needed tools so they could build their capacity. And so some of those tools would be from text messaging, being able to do text messaging campaigns, to do voter outreach, to get voter data. For example, you know, sometimes if you want to get the information for the voters, Black voters in your area, that data could cost you $3,000, $5,000. Grassroots community groups don't have those kind of resources. So we wanted to create a vehicle that we could actually purchase that and give it to them so that those tools become theirs. In addition to that, that we would actually have training and be a strategic thought partner, that we would help them think through strategy, just as the Democratic Party and Republican Party and candidates hire their own consultants. We would be consultants for Black folks, that we would actually make ourselves and our political strategic of the thinking available to our people for us to think about how could we get power. And so that's why we created Black Voters Matter, a Black Voters Matter Capacity Building Institute, and Black Voters Matter Fund. The last thing I'll just say with that organization, I'll talk about Southern Black Girls, with that organization is, you know, there is a really, really important story is important.
Yes.
So who tells the narrative and how that narrative is told?
Look, I say that all the time. I tell, if you don't tell your story, someone else will.
That someone else will. And then they will make themselves and they will slant the story towards whatever benefits them.
That's right. Right?
And so we felt like it was very important. We were very disappointed and frustrated in the way that Black people were talked about in the media, particularly Black folks in the South. You know, in many ways we were dismissed. You know, we're in the South, you in these red states, and so you can't do nothing, you can't win. The Republicans got it on lock, as if we were powerless. You know, and the bottom line is the majority of Black folks in this country live in the South. And so we wanted to make sure that we controlled, we took the narrative and defined who we were, and not from a place of deficit, but from a place of power. And so that all of the messages that we use for our campaigns, they're literally messages about what power we have. And we always, it doesn't matter as where you are, our work is bookmarked by the concepts of love and power. Everything we do is, it's anchored in that. Some folks may have seen it. We got the blackest bus in America that we take around, and it is the blackest bus in America, that we said we're building power and spreading love, that we go to those communities. When you see the bus pull up, that means some work is already happening in that community. That ain't our first time showing up. You know, we're literally coming in and supporting what is already there. The people who are living in those communities, that are in indigenous to those communities, that are embedded in those communities. So we think of ourselves more like a special ops, to come in and support. So that organization and those organizations, because there's several, those organizations, the purpose is to help build Black independent Black political power by resourcing the work and connecting and building the ecosystem. And then the other project that I'm very, very proud of, that I was initially the visionary founder, but I were able to bring three other amazing sisters to anchor this work. And so there's four anchors that are part of this work, and it is called the Southern Black Girls and Women's Consortium. And quite frankly, I wish I could give you kind of this fancy idea how it came, but that's not how it came. It straight came from a vision from God. I was frustrated about a report that had come out. The Southern Black Rural Black Women's Initiative had a report called Unequal Lives. And in that report, it talks about the billions of dollars that are coming into the South through philanthropic dollars, that less than 1% of those resources are going to women and girls. And so a lot of the last 15 years of my life, I've worked in philanthropy. And so, you know, I was like, oh my goodness. I was like, why I can't get philanthropy to do right. And I was thinking about what I was going to do to kind of push philanthropy to make greater investment. I went to sleep, I got up, I took a shower that day, and just as clear like you and I are talking, you know, I just heard in my spirit, like, I could spend my time trying to convince them to do right, or I could show the way, do the work. And so I was like, okay, I couldn't even contain myself. I actually jumped out the shower, and I'm saying this story, and I'm sharing this story from a spiritual piece, because let me tell you, we embed ourselves in the system that make us believe that the only thing that we have is a space around what is logical. We have always, particularly as Black women, think about your mama. Like part of what is as many of our mothers and our grandmothers, it was their intuitiveness. It was that nature of them just knowing. Sometimes they knew just to hug you and say, hey, baby, what you doing? How you doing? Right? There was something about like how our people, and if we really read our history from antiquity, right on up, that we have always been a spiritual people that did not see that there's this logical part that I got to separate from my spiritual part. But I think we are our best when we own the fullness of who we are, which is all of those components. And so I'm raising that because in this piece, with Southern Black girls, it was literally spirit. It was literally me being led by spirit. I jumped out and started writing down what the vision was. I got it just as clear. And so that was about 3 years ago. And so for the first year and a half, for 18 months, we did listening sessions with Black girls all across 12 states in the South. And we did one right in your community. And we had two questions. The first question was, what is a Black girl's dream? What do Black girls dream of?
Powerful.
The second question, part of the question was, what is needed? What is required in order for those dreams to manifest? Those were the two questions of our listening sessions. And so after 18 months, we made our commitment that we were creating the Southern Black Girls and Women's Consortium. We launched our first fund. There are four funds. Our first fund that is called the Black Girls Dream Fund. Because we're going to fund Black girls' dreams all around the South. And so it's $100 million, 10-year initiative to raise and distribute $10 million per year, that we will raise and distribute $100 million over the next decade to organizations that work with Black girls and women. And the beautiful thing about this is that every single one of us from the inception till God dropped the idea in my spirit all the way to the evaluation team, to all the professional consultants, are Black women and girls. That we wanted to show that we could actually create our own solutions that don't look at us as a victim or as a problem, but quite frankly, not only will we save the world for everybody else, but we're going to save the world for ourselves. And so through that process, I'm really excited. We've raised our first $10 million. And so we're on a roll. We're getting it in. We are getting it in. We're going to shift. We're calling it Black Girl-Centered Philanthropy. We're going to shift the way that philanthropy does business, not just in terms of the creation of the fund, but the way that we distribute the resources. Instead of it being people who are not from those communities making decisions, we're creating what we call wisdom panels, right? We're going where the sisters who are connected to the work are going to make decisions around how those resources are distributed. We're going to make sure that Black girls are part of it. One of our, during COVID-19, we had a Black Girl Joy Challenge. And so what we did is we were able to ask Black girls that if you could do something, you could create something to create joy for yourself and 10 people. It could be 10 friends, 10 whatever. Like, we want to support you. We want to invest in you. And we'll give you a $250 grant. We thought we were going to get, initially it wound up being, I think, 50, 50 people. I think we had to keep going. I think we are over 300 now. We couldn't stop. We were like, ooh, these are so good. We couldn't stop. And out of that, Black girls developed businesses. Some Black girls, many of the Black girls, they actually did sessions. They had braiding sessions. They had us up there like, ooh, show me how to braid. They had braiding sessions showing people how to braid. Some girls, I remember there's a young woman who actually makes makeup, right? There were some girls that did video teaching people how to make makeup. There were some girls that did videos how to teach people how to make candles. Part of it is we want to shift this paradigm that our people operate from a deficit. Our people have an abundance of intellect. We have an abundance of creativity, an abundance of innovation. And so in that space, what we were able to do is provide just a little resources, just a little investment for those girls to really tap in and to showcase their talent and their beauty. And it was a beautiful, beautiful thing, so much so that we're actually doing another round this year.
Look, that's fantastic. That's great. I was going to get into this a little bit later, but you've got to teed this up for me.
Okay.
So what are the things that we talk about in Winston-Salem State in terms of our new strategic plan? And it is very consistent with what you just said. Is I look at this plan and I call it a plan about human prosperity, because I think that institutions, HBCUs like Winston-Salem State, have to be in a space of thinking about how we create wealth. You know, and you just mentioned something in terms of the proposals that you receive from these Black girls. What I want to do is I want to make sure that every student that comes to Winston-Salem State, when they leave, they've created their own business. They've created their very own business. So I'm about going out, not only having people get a job, but create jobs and then sustain those jobs. We have to get into these spaces, Latasha, because for some people, and I don't understand this, you know, wealth is a dirty word. Can you please tell us why wealth is not a dirty word and why we ought to be moving into this space?
One, let me just say to you, Chancellor, let me just commend you of just being a visionary. I mean, that is, it's as you were saying that to me, and I knew the work, but for some reason, just now when you said that to me, I actually got chill bumps. Like, I, you know, it's the let's be honest about the whole HBCU movement. HBCU started specifically, you know, when you look at what Booker T. Washington's vision was, right, was that it would be a vehicle for Black folks to be self-sustaining.
Yeah.
The whole idea behind it. That's why many of them initially were A&M universities. Like literally, like it was they were land grant institutions that literally that our people would be self-sustaining. And so the whole notion around how we utilize, you know, it was, you know, I think in many ways, you know, we have reduced this, let me make this distinction. There's a distinction between money and wealth. Yeah. And we collapse the two as if they're the same thing, and they're not.
Right.
One is a part of the other, but it is not a totality of the other. And in my opinion, we have actually chased after money without literally thinking about the totality of building wealth.
Right.
And so I think part of this kind of history around, like what you're saying, that wealth becomes a this bad word, is that in many ways in our community, because it has been a community that has been struggling. It has been a community that has, we've not seen the resources that we've created this, there's been this framework of scarcity that was actually pushed on us, right? That we were in an abundance, right? We live in an abundant world, and we have people right now that are starving, not because food don't exist, it's because the distribution of it is unfair and unjust and inequitable. And so I think part of what has happened is that people respond to what they see. And I think in many ways, we responded to the lack and limitation we saw in our community. And in many ways we would see, and I think part of this was put on us, that part of it is on this idea that in some way we were not supposed to have resources. I don't think that just came. I think that we know that there was a divide and conquer strategy even within when our people were enslaved, that there was that those folks who had resources, they would have upped the Negroes, right? We've heard that before, that those people who had wealth, that they thought that they were better. I've actually heard some people say they think they're better. And I'm like, well, better than what? Like, what's wrong with them thinking they are as good as they are, right? And so there is a thread that actually I think led from was mixed up from envy and jealousy, but also in terms of broken that came out of the brokenness of our spirits, that came out of what was placed on us in terms of thinking that you don't want that because something is wrong with that, right? Like, you know, it was almost like I remember people singing songs around, you know, down here on earth is bad. There were even religious within many of us who grew up in the Christian faith. There are even elements that were in the Christian faith that actually taught us that wealth was a bad thing. You know, I remember consistently hearing it is harder for a rich man to get through an eye needle than like.
We've all heard that one, haven't we?
we have all heard that one, right? And so it created this psyche, you know, for us around that in some way. Wealth is a bad thing, but it's not also that either. We've also seen people in the pursuit of wealth destroy humanity.
Right.
We've seen that, right? We knew that our people, we've seen our children sold for money, right? Like it's hard for me to be excited about money when I'm seeing you sell my baby. Right. And so my point is the traumatic experience that I think that we have had in this country from slavery on down. Like all of that trauma just don't go away. Like, right, like that, that is all, it is all shaped a particular kind of belief we have that I think is related to this notion around wealth and money, which is the opportunity. The good news is that we can change our minds. The good news is that we can actually expand what we see as wealth. The good news is that we have to really recognize, and I believe that we live in a world and in a universe that is abundant. That, you know, if you just look out at the skies, if you don't know abundance, I want you to look at the skies at night and count the stars. Like, and they're saying that's just one galaxy. There are billions of galaxies, right? My point is there is no shortage. This whole notion of lack and scarcity was created and in many ways imposed upon us. And so we have to really change. I think there's a couple of things we have to do, and which is why I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing, is one, we have to reframe how we see what is wealth. And to me, wealth is not just being able to have money. And this is what I mean by that, that health is wealth. Let me tell you, when you are on your sick bed and you dying, right, and you got all the money in the world, that money don't mean nothing, right? But having our health is a part of our wealth building, having the resources that we need. And I think we also have to move away from kind of, we have to individually get wealthy. And this is what I mean by that, that oftentimes, like we have to start thinking creatively around collective ownership.
Sure.
You know, that we, the notion of, like I went to, I did some work in West Africa, and I remember one of the sisters who, Kumba, who is one of my, who I love dearly. She was like, she was talking about the US and she was like, ooh, it's too hard to live over here. She was like, I don't see how y'all do it. And I was like, what? She was like, you don't look for babysitters. Like your compound there, somebody's gonna watch your back. They're not even a question, right? Like she, her point is we've built a life that's centered around our individualism, right? Right. And so that there's other cultures where people actually are doing collective sharing. Right. They're collectively sharing spaces. They're collectively sharing food sources. They're collectively sharing. I remember, you know, when they're going picking off trees, mango off your tree and giving you a chicken. My point is there are some ways that I think that we have to pick up, that we have to see money at the dinero as one element of wealth, right? I also think ownership, when we talk about the means of production, right? We need to literally be able to generate, when we're talking, we ought to be able to generate electricity. We ought to be able to own and own co-ops, electrical co-ops, that we're actually distributing resources to our folks. You may not even get rich off it. I would have co-op. If I can provide electricity to my entire community, I don't need to make any money. If everybody can literally create, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. If I do, fine, but I'm saying that there's different ways that we can actually look at providing resources, basic resources to our community that also can actually lift up the entire community that makes it easier for us. So what you're doing, Chancellor, around every single student to have a business, and I want them to expand their minds of how they see that. That right. Does not mean that you have to have brick and mortar, right? That might mean you are the sister. We know the sisters that know how to put up makeup.
There you go.
Right? We know the brothers that know how to find them jeans, right? We know the sisters that know how to put patches on stuff and hook you up on your clothing. We know those people who actually can sit down and help you write out your business plan. Like there is what I think we have to lead from is a different perspective. We have to lead from the perspective that your gift will make room for you.
Yes.
And so that all of the students that are there, the question isn't you coming up with the next $1 million idea. The question is, how can you use your gift in a way that can actually help build a sustainable future for right. You and your family? There's a Bible verse, and I'll stop at this. There's a Bible verse where Solomon says, you know, plant many crops because you don't know which crop may grow. Perhaps they all will. And so I think that we all have to be, I think we're moving into this era that if you ain't got one, if you ain't got two or three hustles, like, don't put all your faith in a job. Like if we ain't learned nothing else from our Caribbean brothers and sisters and literally being able to be adaptable, you know, and even my own, my family, my ancestors, my folks could do everything. I think about it right now. If there's a big drought, Chancellor, I might starve because I do not know how to grow food. But my grandfather knew how to grow food. They knew how to build that. They built their house. They found their water source. They went and got the well and found their water source. They grew their food. They caught their meat, right? They were in the midst of what was supposed to be, I got to go to work to get all those things. Their basic needs, they were met because they actually had the skill sets to do that. So I'll just offer that I'm hoping that even as the students really take up on that responsibility and we want to, on that opportunity that you're raising, and please look at us as a resource if there's any way that we can be able to be supportive, particularly Black girls, Black young women, that there is for us to really shift our mind the way that we're seeing business, the shift our mind the way that we're seeing economic growth. Like they're sisters and brothers in Africa and the Caribbean, why we can't create trade lines between each other. Exactly. My point is we have to expand the way we're seeing business instead of just chasing on how I'm gonna make the next hot product on Instagram.
Right.
How are you going to use your skills that it can actually bring some sustainable resources for you and your family?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, I think you raise a powerful point in terms of the perspective that you have. And so many people think about not wanting that you're trying to get a piece of the pie, you know, a piece of their pie, and not realizing that the pie is huge and the pie is enough for all of us. And that's what we forget. We forget and we put ourselves in these positions where we do have hunger and we do have poverty. I'm never too far from the work of Jeffrey Sachs, who talks about the end of poverty. And he talks about that because that is a reality. I mean, we have created a system where we've hoarded stuff and not shared stuff and not stuff collectively. And as a result of that, we find ourselves in a situation. A couple quick hitters, because I know I got to get you out of here, in terms of that. As we look at the work that you have been involved in, that you have been on the forefront, particularly the work in Georgia with the election of the senators and presidential election and all the things that you have done, you know, in that space, how do we sustain that? So one of the things that happens is that you get this huge energy around an election. We saw it in 2008. We saw a drop off in 2012. We saw really sort of a people reimagining, you know, getting people to vote and so forth. And you guys, you and many others have done a great job. And tell the folks why the work that was done in Georgia was not the goal, but it was to change, transform the way we do things, as opposed to saying that's an end all.
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. You know, that ultimately, this isn't about participation. This is about power. We have all witnessed. I don't know about you, Chancellor, but at one point, a couple of years ago, about 3 years ago, I was scared to go on social media because I knew it was going to be another video of another brother or sister shot. Right? I was almost like it was at one point it was coming like every week. I was like, what is happening? Right? And so I'm raising this because part of what I fundamentally believe is at the point in which we really, when we decide is enough is enough, it's gonna stop, right? Yeah. We decide, when we literally kind of manifest the energy, build the power, do the work that literally supports this notion that Black Lives Matter, it will stop. And so my point is, part of our work isn't, I'm one of those people, I don't believe that Black liberation is contingent upon white acceptance, right? My goal isn't that I got to get white folks to not like, to stop hating us, and then that's what's going to make it stop. No, no, no. What I believe is that me standing in the space of love and power and getting my people to really understand the magnificence of their creation and who they are and how we can collectively use our power and that we can radically reimagine every single system. And when systems don't work for us, we need to replace them, right? That if I can literally get our people to really think in those terms, right? And while we are also providing some protection for us, that we will actually create new ways of being, that we will approach this differently. And people, like, whether they with or without, I mean, whether they want to or not, they're going to have to respond to us differently. Right. And so my point is, part of the work that we're doing is about really affirming the power that we have as a people and as a community. Part of the work that we're doing is affirming that we're not telling people to vote because we want people to believe in the system. We want people to believe in themselves, because right. people who believe in themselves don't continue to accept unjust systems. They don't go around the world. Historically, they don't. Right. Matter of fact, the foundation of this country was based on here, even though they did something completely different here. But the whole reason why literally the Boston Tea Party happened, and what literally set off the American Revolution, is that there were folks from England who were settlers here that felt like, we sending all of our money and our resources back to the Queen, and she ain't looking out for us. Forget that. We can create our own thing. My point is that whenever people get to the point where they really recognize their value and they're tired, right, that they start being very creative and imaginative of what is possible. And so right. what we want is, we want our people to play in the possibilities of our power. For right. us to really know what our power means, let's play in the possibilities of what that creates. We've done it before, sir. You are sitting at an institution that was envisioned, created by folks who were formerly enslaved, right? That in itself, in a space, like, think about it. Right. For 200 years, our people, like, literally, it was illegal for Black folks to read and write. Yet Black folk had enough imagination and innovation and belief in themselves that they created not just institutions, but institutions that would be higher learning institutions, that they had the audacity to create institutions with teachers. These are the same folk that were told that they couldn't read or write, that it was illegal, that they would be killed. Right. right? That is some imagination for you. And so what I'm saying to you is, we're from those folks. Those are our ancestors. And so in this space where we got all of this technology, we got access to all of these resources, we have to use our imaginations, our radical reimaginations, right, to think about what is possible for our people to go to the next level. We should be able to figure out. I'm not waiting on the federal government to figure out how we can house Black folk. We should be able to figure out, how can we provide quality housing? How can we develop them? How can we look and create a different kind of system that everybody don't have to go in debt buying a house by house by house? But are there ways for us to really be able to create housing that would serve our community? Can we build cities? I don't know if the students know, or folks who are listening to this, that just 8 years after Emancipation Proclamation, there were over 80 cities that formerly enslaved people had founded. Somebody better hear me. Mm-hmm. That at the end of the day, there were folks who had a fraction of the resources that we had, a fraction of the education that we had, a fraction of all of the access to resources and the means of production that we have, right? And they founded over 80 cities. Are we continuing to found 80 cities? Are we creating cities? We should be nation builders. And so I'm raising this not as a point of critique. I'm raising it as to jog our memory of who we are and what is possible. And so that we don't fall asleep around what it seems now, right? Because I can tell you, a check will put you to sleep, right? I understand, but a check will put you to sleep, right? But literally, yes, get your check, get your money. I want you to get your money. But at the same time, we have to go beyond that and think as Black futurists. We have to think about what kind of nation building. What are we going to build? How are we going to create health institutions that would actually take care of our people? Could we imagine creating, like, think about it. Like the open heart surgery was Black folk created, Black folk? Like, I can go down and down in the line. I think our challenge right now is that oftentimes, and I'm just going to be honest, I think in many ways, it kind of the acceptance in the larger culture and this kind of this constant check, this constant running around following capitalism to get a check, we have missed the journey of building wealth. Like, yes, I'm going to get my check, right? I want my check. But what I want to do is, I want to build a context to build wealth for my people. I want to create. I want to build. I am just like Facebook and all of those. We should be innovators. We should be Black futurists. And so we have to take this as an opportunity, not just go get a job, get your job. I got you, right? And get your check. But that should not impact your ability to think innovatively. and stretch yourself to believe what it is that we can create out the power of our own imaginations.
Oh, fantastic. I love that. I'm going to get you out of here. When I think about you and I think about the fact that you believe in democracy and you believe in, as I look at it, sort of a humanitarian type of democracy, not the typical democracy that we've come accustomed to. And I appreciate your perspective on that. You, because you have done this, and I want you to help, our listeners deal with this as well. As we look back over the past 13 months, and we have seen, all the atrocities that have happened in this country to African Americans, the Black and Brown communities. Now we see to the Asian community. We've seen so much happen, atrocities in this country in the past 13 months. How do you've been able to do this? So tell us how we should be able to, in that space, continue to promote our humanity. How do we deal with our healing? And how do we find joy in that space, given all of that we've seen and witnessed? You've done that, Latosha Brown. You need to tell us, how do we do that?
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. You know, I think part of it is I'm such a grandmama's baby, so I always remember things that my grandmother said. I don't think I understood them at the time, but now I understand them, and I loved it. I just love her to say it because it was her sayings, right? But she would always say, the devil ain't give me this joy, and the devil can't take it away, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, that there is a spirit of joy. That's the part that I think we have to draw on something deeper than what we just see. Like there's a part that we're living in this physical world. And so we have to really be mindful of what is happening to us. And that's why we have a responsibility of fighting against that. But while we're fighting against that and those things that, and that evil and that darkness, we also recognize that just a little bit of light in the room disrupts the darkness. It breaks that room. You can have that room black, dark, right? I actually like to sleep in a really, really dark room. And every once in a while, my cable TV, it does something at night. I forgot. It like, it updates.
Right. The light comes on. It drives me crazy.
All right. And it disrupts the whole room. It's like a little bitty light. I'm like, right? That one little light disrupts the room, right? And what I'm saying is all of us have light. That literally we have to realize that we are light unto the world, that we actually standing in our power, using our voice, really creating a vision of what people can see, really doing the work, that we are sometimes the only light that people can see. And so we have a responsibility. For me, when I am like really having a moment, I have to draw from my humanity. I have to draw from something that don't nobody else control. Nobody can say, you can't stop me from singing. You can't stop me from feeling. You can't stop me from whatever that is in here. Right. And so I think we have to literally be able, that's what sustained our people. Can you imagine our people who were on the middle passage, what they had to endure? Something in them had to say, I got to survive, because we are the descendants of those that survived. We would not be here. So there was something in them that said, I got to survive. And they had to pull from something. It couldn't be around what they saw. They were in the midst of the bowels of the ship, and all they saw was tragedy and trauma. But there was something in them that saw something greater. And I'm saying to you is that is before us now. That there is some, love is always available, right? When we are feeling down, I'm like, go find you some love. And what I mean by that is like, and it's not just love. Like it's not just somebody got to love you. Literally generating and creating love. Your friends. Right. I don't know what I would do without my sister girls. I just don't know what I would do without the sisterhood. Right. I don't know what I would do. I don't even want to live in a world ain't no brothers exist. Let me just be clear. I like the men folk, our babies, people around us, our grandmas. Like sometimes just literally we're so caught up in the doingness of who we are, because we're in this capitalist system that is constantly around what you produce, that oftentimes we don't have to take the time just to be. And sometimes my best times have been being able to sit on the yard. I remember sitting on the yard, drinking a Coca-Cola, with just watching folks walk by and laughing with my friends. Just something that simple. My point is the way that we have to draw our strength has to come from inside of us. That is not what we think. It's not like all of what the world is going to give us, right? It's really in us. And that when we're centered and grounded, it's like an oak tree. When an oak tree is grounded, when a tornado comes, it might move to the side. Every once in a while, there's something to get uprooted. But there's a oak tree in my yard that's been there, I know, probably 1,000 years, right? And she don't go nowhere. She lead. Every once in a while, she lead to the side, but her roots are deep. So the deeper you make your roots, when your roots are in your family, when your roots are in your values and in your principles, when your roots are in something greater than you see out here based on the market, based on this racism, based on white supremacy, that you can, you are like a tree that can only sway in the wind, that you ain't gonna be uprooted. And so I, to me, that's how I draw. And oftentimes when I don't have anything else, I can't draw from, you know, I gotta read the news or whatever, I have to turn it all off. And sometimes right. I just go and just be among the trees. And I just ask, I just say, thank you, God. Like, or I was like, thank you, ancestors. Or I'll see a rose, something as simple so that reminds me of, it don't matter how powerful folks think they are, right? It don't matter how big the dinosaurs were. They ain't here now, right? So at the end of the day, that I have to just stand in and pull from the power. And for me, it's love and really my belief and my faith that there's something greater that I'm a part of and I'm working with, and that I am surrounded by love. And I always have the opportunity to actually show and generate love.
I appreciate that. I mean, it's such a nice way to end the show. You have been such a great guest. You brought energy, you brought passion, you brought perspective. And you have a lot for us to think about. We think about going forward. So, and you're invited. You're always invited to come to Winston-Salem State. I know you got to go. You got to get out of here. You're going to jump on another show.
Make sure
that you get a shout out to Winston-Salem State University. So we appreciate you being on.
Absolutely. And I will be back. I will be to Winston-Salem on the Blackest Bus in America. So I'll call you and let's make it work out. Thank you so much, Chancellor. I appreciate you and blessings to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone. And come back again next week for another edition of Future Focus Now.